For those who need distraction from the tax deadline next week, you can read about other people's money in this week's book review, devoted entirely to the subject of money, whether it's too much or lack thereof. Just how fun is the world of finance for its post-financial crisis traders? Chris Hayes will join us to talk about his review of Young Money, Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits by Kevin Roos.
This sense of scrambling, competing, being better than others but not quite good enough. And I actually think that is a really, really potent and often toxic kind of combination.
What's the relationship between the income gap and our justice system? Timothy Noah is here to talk about The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, the new book from Matt Taibbi.
Basically, he's saying that poverty itself is being criminalized, the best example being his discussion of the stop and frisk policy in New York City.
My colleagues, John Williams and Pearl Sagal, chat this week about the book business. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Chris Hayes joins us now to talk about his review of Young Money, Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits, new book by Kevin Roos in this week's Money issue of the Book Review. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So this book enters into the uncovered territory of young people on Wall Street. I say that obviously ironically, given that everything from Liar's Poker to The Wolf of Wall Street, as you mentioned in your review, has covered this same ground. But what does Roos do in this book, and how is it different?
So I think the thing that Roos does best to differentiate this book from the by now massive canon of Wall Street Chronicles is to focus on the very lowest rung, the analysts, the first-year analysts, and particularly the transition from college recruitment to being a first-year analyst.
Right.
So he follows these people on this trajectory. So much about the canon, with its kind of broad caricatures of testosterone, ambition, greed, all that stuff, as a reporter who's reported on Wall Street a fair amount, like, is pretty correct in
right,
a lot
right.
of ways. So that's one of the challenges for writing this kind of book. The process by which people become acculturated to that world, I think, is probably a bit under-examined mm-hmm. in the canon. And so that, I think, is a kind of comparative advantage, to use a very Wall Street term, of
we'll
Roos's,
try to avoid the inevitable Wall Street jargon. And he's trying to do something bigger, too, right? He's trying to say, like, what's changed since the crash, and what's changed maybe since also Silicon Valley has become more prestigious. And
yeah, he in the very beginning of the book, he relays an anecdote that in which he's at some kind of somewhat fancy dinner party, and I think it's a Princeton grad who says they're going to finance, and it's right after the crash, and people kind of like look at her with this kind of pity or contempt or something like that. And he thinks to himself, oh, how that kind of gets him thinking about how the crash has changed Wall Street. And I actually think one of the things that is both the most revealing part of the book and the most unsatisfying from a narrative perspective mm-hmm. is that not much has changed.
Right.
And I don't think he can quite allow himself to quite come out and say that as much as it is true on the
right.
pages of the book.
It kind of certainly feels that way. Like every time you see like, well, bonuses are rolling in and they're just as big as ever. And
My favorite example of this, I don't even think this made the review. I think I cut this paragraph in the draft. But there's one of his characters is a woman who ends up in the risk management part of the bank.
Right.
One of the great things that came out of the autopsies of the crash that almost everyone agrees in is that the institutional power between the trading desks and risk management was totally out of whack. That risk management had no status inside the building. And so when meetings would happen and the traders are saying, we got to do X, Y, and Z, and risk managers are saying, I don't know if that's that smart.
Right.
It's like, no one cares about you. You don't make much money. Go back to your little world. Right.
Right.
Now, you would think maybe that would change after the biggest financial crash in 70 years. But what happens is we see that same status inequality inside the building institutionally replicated again, as
right.
if nothing happened. And he sort of talks about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that to me was kind of a screaming headline. Like,
right.
here we are. And this same culture that produced the crash is just completely intact.
I mean, one of the interesting things about that distinction is that I think that a lot of people, you know, who aren't in the world of finance kind of look at the world of finance and think like, okay, those guys. But there are all of these distinguishing, you know, there's the investment bankers, there are the traders, there are the hedge fund quants, there are the back office versus the front office. who is he talking about here?
So he has what I think is really good about the book is that the people he follows, and I think there's about 8 or 9, I forget the precise number, go into various different parts of the bank. And one of the things about Wall Street is it's got this kind of fractal competition and status obsession. There is no point at which like you have arrived at the inner sanctum. There's always another wall to penetrate.
Right.
So you get recruited and then it's like, well, you want to go to one of the really big banks. And then once you're in one of the really big banks, you want to go into the front office, not the back office, right? You want to be, for instance, on a trading desk and not in risk management. Then once you're on a trading desk, you want to be in one of the hot trading desks.
Right.
And then once
right.
you're on the one a hot trading desk, you want to be working closest to the hot shot boss, right? That and you see the way that replicates itself just infinitely and exhaustingly in the pages of the book as you follow these various people who are never satisfied.
Right.
And in fact, the whole system is set up to make it so that no one is ever satisfied.
There's always going to be a bigger dog.
Yep.
And the 8 people you mentioned earlier, there was a woman. I'm curious if there were any. How many? What was the gender breakdown there?
I want to say that there are 2 women who stick out to me. One who goes by the name of Chelsea, and the other who is the woman who is in risk management. I think it's just 2 of the 8 are women, if I'm not mistaken.
And these are pseudonyms?
Yeah, they're all pseudonyms. And there's a little bit of a kind of a yellow flag in the beginning where he says, you know, I've changed the names, obviously, and some of the chronology has been adjusted. So there are points at which you kind of something dramatic happens. You just got to check yourself a little bit. Like,
right.
Am I sure this is what actually went down?
Although that's interestingly almost like a legalism that's kind of thrown
right.
into like, you know, the same way it's in the beginning of a memoir. Like some of the
yes.
dialogue is reconstructed, but I can see how that would set bells off. Does he follow them through a year? Is it like, okay, we're going to go through the recruiting process starting in the university and then
through
to bonus time?
Yes, or? Basically that's right. And one of the arcs is someone who basically sets a clock to quit.
Right.
He's actually doing quite well. And then he just like works up until the day when it's quitting day and he does quit and he goes off to do a start off with a buddy of his. 2 of the more heartbreaking one is this guy who's a kind of immigrant striver who gets this very rare disease. And the entire time that he is battling this awful rare disease and recovering, he's just filled with stress and anxiety. He's missing work and that he's falling behind. And you just see like how perverse this whole thing is where
right.
everyone is kind of saying to him, it's fine, take some time. But he understands institutionally that's not true. And then there's a really interesting case of a Haitian American guy. He views his own performance as good.
Mm-hmm.
He's a real kind of like bootstrap story, right?
Right.
comes from a world in which people don't have this kind of money at all and thinks he's doing well and then just walks into his first year bonus and it's just a buzzsaw
right.
and he's told basically his performance is bad and he's not going to get an offer and that's upsetting. But it's also, you know, the kind of precariousness of all these people, the degree
right.
to which they we view on the outside people in Wall Street as having made it, and their lived experience is of constant precariousness.
Right.
And
well, it's kind of like those happiness studies that show that, you know, it's not about how much money you have, but it's how much money you have relative to the other people who
yep,
are around you.
Absolutely.
And they're just sort of constantly surrounded by excess.
Yes. It is the ultimate hedonic treadmill, right? It is. I say there's something in the review about a sort of stairmaster to spiritual exhaustion. I mean, it's You just keep climbing and you never get anywhere.
Right. Now, as long as we're weeping for Wall Streeters here, I mean, I do think it's interesting to point out, as you do in the review, that, you know, they don't actually, I mean, they make more than the average American salary, but like they're in one of the most expensive cities in the country and they don't make a lot for New York City. And it's mostly not base salary, but bonus, which I guess puts them in this weird mode of kind of having to live at a higher level than they necessarily can afford.
Right, and there's expectations of what that looks like. But I think if you say to someone, well, this is a sort of sob story about how hard it is to be a first-year analyst, it's like, well, what do I care? Like, you know, there are 45 million Americans living in poverty, for instance. The reason I think Kevin Roos was really smart to follow this path in terms of chronicling Wall Street, and the reason it's really important, is that the vision that finance has for the rest of America is a vision of constant precariousness.
Right.
It is a vision of like a world, a labor market in which anyone can be liquidated at any time, basically for any reason. That Wall Street actually walks the walk in certain ways
right.
in their institutional culture, which is like this, to me, horrible vision of constant terror, insecurity, and competition
right.
is what they think the entire American labor market should be like.
Well, and also, I mean, these people, their motivations for going into it, their the ways in which they're rewarded, what it is that takes makes them succeed, these people are going to be the ones who are controlling much yep. of everything yep. eventually. And so it's interesting to know what values kind of guide that process.
Right. And he writes, Roots writes about the kind of watching that acculturation process play out. There's one character who's sort of a, you know, he goes from his dating a sweetheart at Madison to like sleeping with a model, and it's kind of the, you know, sort of perfect little trajectory of
right.
of collegiate
aspiration.
Right, exactly. And he also talks about the ways in which they, the sort of jargon changes, the way they kind of see the world, this sort of hardening of the way they view balance sheets and as opposed to lives, right? You start to more and more detach one from the other. The fact that there's a line in there that I think is in the review, which is he asked them about moral qualms they might have, particularly on Wall Street in the wake of the crash, etc. And mostly gets the same answer, which is like, I am just trying not to screw up.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's something profound at the core of that about what are the cultures that produce real kind of systematic moral transgression. And if you go to a place like Penn State in the Joe Paterno era, right, it wasn't like it was filled with knaves, right?
Right?
It's just a lot of people who are focused on one thing, staying in their lane, not alerting the right people to things that are going wrong, you know. And you look at institution after institution where this kind of things happen, that tends to be the case. If people kind of get acculturated to just like keeping their head down and doing their thing. And in that, you can get some real nasty stuff festering.
And the thing that you're judged by is, I mean, it's not like in another job where you might be rewarded because you're an excellent manager or because you're a creative thinker. You come up with, you know, good ways for people to work together. But it's really how much money
numbers,
did you make?
Numbers, yeah.
At the cost of all else. One last thing. You had a statistic in here that I thought was interesting, given that this is kind of college time, college acceptance time, college graduation time that we're going into. You point out that 36% of the 2010 Princeton class who had full-time jobs at graduation went into finance, that it's gone down since before the crash. But that's still a really startling statistic.
It's remarkable how kind of well-worn the path from elite universities to Wall Street has become. And it's gone down a little bit after the crash, but it's still very high. And Roos makes actually a really interesting and good point in the book about that, which is that in some ways it's kind of a risk-averse choice.
Right.
Like it's a way of forestalling some profound question about what you're going to do. It's actually – it's something that looks almost like 2 years of grad school. It's marketed to people as come do this for 2 years. Same way that Teach for America, which is
right,
it's basically
right.
Wall Street and Teach for America are like two of the highest feeder destinations for these graduates.
A surprising number of them actually go on to become novelists at some point, interestingly. You wrote a book, obviously, on meritocracy, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, thinking about this Princeton graduation statistic and this look at the way in which this meritocracy. Did you have any new insights into the subject of your book after reading this one?
I guess it's lame to say this because it just sounds like confirmation bias, but it's sort of perfectly tracked with precisely the kind of culture that I was describing in that book. This idea of a combination of fear and insecurity with superiority. And that is in some ways the defining feature of the Wall Street that we see through the eyes of these young analysts. And it's also the defining feature of the sort of top of the meritocratic pyramid. This sense of scrambling, competing, being better than others, but not quite good enough.
Right.
And I actually think that is a really, really potent and often toxic kind of combination.
All right. Well, good news for a very, 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 very few number of people, and maybe not so much for others. Chris Hayes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Chris Hayes. He is the host of All In on MSNBC, and this week reviews Young Money, Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits by Kevin Roos. Carl Sagal and John Williams join us now to talk a little bit about what's going on in the book business this week. Hi, Carl.
Hi,
hi, John. So self-publishing is sort of having a bit of a moment. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Paul?
Sure. Well, it's always like the specter that haunts publishing, and self-published authors got a good bit of news this week. On Tuesday, The Guardian announced that they're going to start doing a monthly prize. They're going to open themselves up to all sorts of self-published writers and sort of choose one and market that one, and I think even introduce them to other publishers to sort of find a wider platform.
How do you define a self-published author? I mean, obviously it's not with a major publishing house, but you have vanity presses. I mean, if somebody, some kid scribbles something down and posts it on the refrigerator, does that count? I mean, what's the definition?
I think you're right. I think it is people going through all sorts of different mediums. Some of them are going through small vanity presses. A lot of them are going through Amazon. Print on demand has been a huge, huge sort of revolutionary development in self-publishing. Essentially, what print on demand is that you publish a book, and whenever you want a physical copy, you can just order one or two or three off Amazon.
But you have to pay for the actual publication.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And are they counting ebook only ebooks, or does it have to have some print incarnation?
I think they're counting ebooks as well. And I think one of the big reasons that this started was that they looked at ebook numbers, and they said that, I think the figure was 1 in 5 of the 80 million ebooks purchased in 2013 were self-published. And so Claire Armistead, the editor of Guardian Books, said that this was a phenomenon too big to ignore anymore. So they had to sort of try to get in the game. And they have been, to some degree. They've been holding workshops for self-published writers and classes. I mean, there's money to be made is also the perspective that has to be looked at.
I think too big is a key phrase because, I mean, there's a terrifying number of books published by, regular established publishing houses. And now adding to that are all of these self-published books, and there's been a question in the media overall, not just at The Guardian and at The Times, but throughout, how do you deal with all these books? Can you review them? The trade publications have been doing some interesting things in the last few years.
They have. PW has a program called PW Select where you pay some money. And
this is Publishers Weekly.
Publishers Weekly, and you are listed in the magazine that your book is coming out, and then they will review, I think, about 10 to 20 books a month, whereas Kirkus, you can pay money to have your book reviewed. You can pay a little bit of extra money if you want it expedited, a quick review. And you can even ask if you don't want your review to run in the magazine.
So yeah, if you don't like the review, can you get your money back?
I was going to say, I want the premium package where I get a good review.
Right, that's
I'll pay
exactly
double.
It.
Tell me how brilliant I am.
Yeah, but it is a tricky thing. And when you look at how genre writers, genre bestseller lists apparently are increasingly dominated, so some say, by self-published authors. And then you look at people like Alan Sepinwall, who's a television critic who had a huge following, and he decided to self-publish his book, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. It was reviewed by Machiko Kakutani in The Times. It got a lot of mainstream attention, and this is the sort of thing that The Guardian and The Times are starting to, I think about.
And self-published works have even won literary prizes.
I think that The Guardian mentioned in announcing the prize that one of the motivations was, Sergio de la Pava wrote a very big, long novel called A Naked Singularity that was self-published a couple of years ago. And then the University of Chicago picked it up. They don't usually do contemporary fiction. And then it won the Penn Robert Bingham Award for Debut Fiction, which is a $25,000 prize, and it's fairly prestigious. And I think that was a real eye-opener for people, that if something could be self-published and then get to that point, that maybe we're missing out on some things. Now, how they're going to handle the volume of submissions they get, I don't know, because there must be, I don't know who's going to read all of those.
I was going to say, I'm feeling sorry for the judges.
I am too, yeah. I would feel bad for the judges even of a mainstream prize, because of the volume.
This is a big week now for prizes. The Guggenheims were just announced today, and the Pulitzers are going to be announced on Monday.
Yeah, in just a few days.
And there's another award that has...
Yeah, this week, the International Impact Dublin Literary Award, which is a mouthful, which has been awarded since 1996, announced its list of 10 shortlist finalists. And this is an award that is based in Dublin, but has a very international flavor because it's open to authors and books from any country as long as they were published in English at some point in their life. And so the nominating process for this prize is kind of unique. They ask public libraries worldwide to suggest potential works of merit. And because they ask so many libraries and librarians, the long list that they release, which they did in the fall, is astonishingly long. There were 152 books on it this year.
What wasn't on it then?
If you weren't on it, you should feel really, you wrote a terrible novel. No. And so now they've narrowed it down to 10. And the 10 are The Detour by Gerbrand Bakker, Questions of Travel by Michelle de Kretzer, Absolution by Patrick Flannery, A Death in the Family, which is the second volume in, or the first volume in Karl Ove Knausgård's autobiographical series.
My Struggle.
My Struggle. Three Strong Women by Marie Ndiaye.
Nice.
Thank you. Traveler of the Century by Andreas Newman. The Light of Amsterdam by David Park. The Spinning Heart by Donal Ryan. The Garden of Evening Mists by Tan Tuan Eng. And The Sound of Things Falling by Juan Gabriel Vasquez. And two of those books, Three Strong Women and The Sound of Things Falling, were reviewed on our cover. And several others were reviewed in our pages. So,
and one looks like it's actually Irish.
The Donal Ryan. And actually, last year it was won by Kevin Barry for his novel City of Bohan, which was actually reviewed on our cover, and he's an Irish writer. So
we're not going to say it's slanted in any way.
No, it's
Irish
not.
Writers,
and five of these books were translated into English, so there's definitely an international flair. And it's hard to say that there's a favorite on this list. The winner will be announced on June 12th and receive 100,000 euros, or about $140,000, which makes it one of the more lucrative prizes. And I think, you know, Knausgård is having kind of a moment, but it's a strong list overall.
And are they letting in self-published authors?
Not yet.
All right. Well, to be continued. Thank you so much, Don.
Thanks,
Parle.
Thank you.
Timothy Noah joins us now. He reviewed this week for us Matt Taibbi's new book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Pamela.
This book is about not just the wealth gap, which is the subject of many books, including one that you wrote called The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. But it's about the relationship between the wealth, the inequality gap, and the justice system. What is Matt Taibbi's argument?
Well, of course, the gap between rich and poor when it comes to the administration of justice is an old story and a familiar story. And I, for that reason, I approach this book with some skepticism. But he really makes it fresh again and argues that the problem has gotten worse, just as income inequality and wealth inequality have gotten worse in recent years. He says that violent crime has been falling in America by 44% during the past two decades, and yet during that same time, the prison population has more than doubled. So that's a strange disparity. We're seeing a drop in crime, even as the prisons are filling up faster and faster. Basically, he's saying that poverty itself is being criminalized, the best example being his discussion of the stop-and-frisk policy in New York City.
He opens the book talking about stop-and-frisk.
Yes. And meanwhile, at the other end of the income distribution, he talks about white-collar crime, and which, of course, is not a new story either, but he says that it really has reached epidemic proportions, and the record settlements that we've been seeing in recent years do seem to suggest that. We're seeing lots of settlements, but what we aren't seeing are a lot of prosecutions of highly placed figures, and Taibbi says that's actually a conscious strategy on the part of the Obama administration, that there's concern first enunciated by the Attorney General Eric Holder back when he was a deputy Attorney General for Bill Clinton, that any aggressive prosecution of the big banks could destabilize the economy. Too big to fail equals too big to prosecute.
Right.
And as a result, you know, Wall Street actually has less to fear from President Obama's Justice Department than it did from President Bush's.
You've mentioned, you know, up front that this is obviously not a new story, but I'm curious to get a sense, better sense of the time frame, because when we talk about the gap between, for example, CEO pay and the average worker pay, people usually use as a benchmark the early 70s. Is he talking about the last 40 years, or is he talking about the Bush, Clinton, Obama administrations, or where does he date this to?
Well, he dates the filling up of the prisons back about 20 years,
mm-hmm.
Which covers two-thirds of what I call the Great Divergence, which began in 1979. He dates the breakdown in Wall Street prosecutions to the end of the Clinton administration, and especially the start of the Obama administration. He says there was, at the start of the Obama administration, there were a number of big, high-profile, botched prosecutions that made the Justice Department especially gun-shy.
Okay, let's get to Matt Taibbi a little bit about his approach and his background. For those listeners who are not familiar with Taibbi, who is he?
He is a very popular writer for Rolling Stone magazine, probably most famous for once describing Goldman Sachs as a vampire squid. And he has always kind of written, or previously written, in a kind of gonzo style that I found very off-putting, frankly. I was not a Taibbi fan before I read this book. But this book is a real accomplishment. First of all, he has dialed back the mannered prose so that the reporting really shines through. And the reporting is really good. I mean, I never noticed before, either because his reporting has gotten deeper or because I was so distracted by his prose mannerisms that I didn't notice. He is a really good reporter, and he gets a lot of really interesting stories detailing, you know, very complex realities, particularly with regard to Wall Street. You know, sort of writing about Wall Street is not easy because the kinds of crimes that occur there are very complex, and he's very good at walking the reader through those. And he's equally good at probing the criminal justice system as it affects lower-income people and making the characters come alive on the page and really depicting in a very affecting way the kind of bureaucratic madness that they get caught up in.
This is kind of a technical question, but I'm curious. I mean, you mentioned this is a very heavily reported book and well reported, but it interestingly, it does not have footnotes. It does not have sources. Did he mostly do firsthand kind of getting out there and telling people stories kind of reporting on the ground?
With regard to the reporting on lower income people, yes, it's very clear he did that. I would imagine that the reporting concerning Wall Street crimes involved a lot of reconstructions. He obviously wasn't there when these crimes were occurring. But, you know, one thing about white-collar crime in this day and age, we hear a lot about how hard it's gotten to prosecute white-collar crime because it's so complex. And then again, there's the Holder argument that you risk upsetting the economy if you go too aggressively after the big players. But the other side of the story is that, you know, email is just God's gift to prosecutors. It is clear we live in a society where it is absolutely impossible to communicate without email, even when you're conspiring to commit crimes. So the quality of evidence that's available both to prosecutors and to Taibbi as a reporter is pretty impressive.
I thought it was interesting. You mentioned that technology is driving new kinds of inequalities, but you would think that technology would implicate more the well-off, the white collar, as opposed to the, you know, street level crime. You talk about getting stopped for riding a bicycle on the side walk or stop and frisk or that kind of thing.
Yes, you would think that. And obviously you don't catch people out on the street with computers. You go out in the street and you, as Taibbi depicts it, almost randomly gather up low-income African-American males in a paddy wagon. You ride around with them. You try and find out if there is anything at all you can charge them with. And if you can't, you send them home. It's an absolutely deplorable practice, but it's a low-tech practice.
Mm-hmm.
Where technology comes into it is you get a very powerful sense from Taibbi's book, something I'd never really thought about before, that, you know, increasingly the system, and when I say the system, I mean government and business, is having a harder and harder time treating us as individuals. It's scaling up and it's in the way it surveys our comings and goings. That's, you know, very dangerous. And, you know, we saw that with the scandals involving the robo-signing of mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
These subprime mortgages were kind of given a rubber stamp, and therefore nobody was really going through the paperwork to see if it was right. And you had a lot of people wrongly accused of not paying their mortgage and kicked out of their houses. But you also see it in, say, the processing of welfare claims. It's done from about 30,000 feet. And if there is a mistake, the government agencies are constantly looking for evidence of fraud, and they're frequently making mistakes about that. And if there is a mistake, it just becomes unstoppable. There is no human being intervening to say, well, wait, this doesn't really check out. So what I took away from Taibbi's book was this very kind of troubling picture of a future where merely getting individual attention from a bank or from the government may be becoming a kind of luxury, like a bespoke suit or a designer gown. And the haves will be able to receive that individual attention, and the have-nots won't. For example, at the beginning of the book, Taibbi tells a really, really haunting story of a young man who is arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic in Bedford-Stuyvesant. This man, Andrew Brown, is furious. He's been picked up for this. He goes to court, and he is assigned a public defender.
He's a 35-year-old black man, right? From
35-year-old black man, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's assigned a public defender, not somebody who makes his living as a public defender, but somebody who's been assigned for that day to act as public defender. He starts to explain his situation to his lawyer, which was he was coming home from work. He was outside his apartment house. He ran into a friend. They chatted for a few minutes before he was going inside. Because it was 1 a.m, there was no pedestrian traffic to block. This is a pretty simple explanation for his actions, and it just doesn't penetrate his lawyer's brain. I mean, the lawyer keeps saying, well, why don't you just plead guilty and
pay the $25?
Yeah, and also he expresses great surprise that a 35-year-old black man in Bedford-Stuyvesant would even have a job. You know, finally he manages to penetrate the guy's skull that he is not going to plead guilty, and they go before the judge, and they go through this whole routine again with the judge. The judge just cannot fathom that the 35-year-old black man appearing before him in court would plead not guilty to blocking pedestrian traffic. I mean, after all, this is a charge that ought to be very easy to make stick, right? And when all you have to do is stand in the middle of a sidewalk. And the lawyer says to the judge, you know, I don't know, for some reason this guy doesn't want to plead guilty. And only after this ridiculous routine, it's, you know, right out of a Joseph Heller novel, goes on for, you know, a couple of minutes, does the judge turn to the arresting cop and say, well, was there any pedestrian traffic to block when this occurred? And the cop says, well, no, not really. He says, case dismissed. And then afterwards, Taibbi goes back into the hallway with the lawyer to talk about it. And he says, you know, what's going on here where you're, you know, arresting people for blocking pedestrian traffic? You never arrest people for blocking pedestrian traffic in affluent neighborhoods. And the lawyer, who again is spending the day defending low income clients, says low class people do low class things. What that illustrates to me is the absolute perverse refusal to take into account individual circumstances of any case, which is, of course, what the whole justice system exists to do.
Wow, that's a pretty damning story. Tim, thank you so much for joining us to talk about the book. It's just one of many very disturbing stories in Matt Taibbi's new book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Timothy Noah reviews it this week in our Money issue of the Book Review. Tim, thanks so much again.
Thank you, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's on the list this week?
Well, on the hardcover fiction list, there are a bunch of new titles. Starting down at number 16, the 80-year-old British romance novelist Barbara Taylor Bradford has a new historical novel set in Edwardian England called Cavendon Hall, and that's new at number 16.
We're traveling up the list.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Counting them down, Casey Kasem style. At number 15, another British author, Emma Donoghue, whose previous novel, Room, was also a bestseller and one of our best books of 2010, her new novel, Frog Music, hits the list at number 15. And our listeners may not know that Emma Donoghue's father is an eminent Irish literary critic, Dennis Donoghue.
Good. Okay.
Then at number 11, another British writer, Ted Bell, who has a series of novels about a British secret agent named Alex Hawke. The latest book in that series is called Warriors, and that's new at number 11. The funny thing there is that there's actually a young Australian member of parliament who's also named Alex Hawke, spelled the same way, H-A-W-K-E. I'm not sure if it's a coincidence that helped him get elected or if Ted Bell actually named his spy after the politician. But if you Google Alex Hawke, you will find both of them.
And they're not the same person?
Not that we know of.
Okay.
Then new at number 8, the novel Destroyer Angel by Nevada Barr. That is the 18th novel in Barr's Anna Pigeon series. Anna Pigeon is a National Park Service ranger who keeps stumbling across dead bodies. The plot is kind of like a feminist Rambo. Anna Pigeon is camping with some friends of hers, including a paraplegic in a wheelchair. While Anna is out on her own one day, she comes back and finds that all of her friends have been held hostage at gunpoint. So she goes into hiding and kind of needs to track down and take care of the kidnappers one by one. A fairly violent book, but also fairly gripping.
Okay.
At number 7, another series, Donna Leon's Commissario Brunetti series. This is her series of mysteries set in Venice. Donna Leon is American, but she herself has lived in Venice for more than 25 years. This novel is called By Its Cover. It's new at number 7. American crime novels are very big overseas. They translate easily, and they're very popular. Donna Leon's are no different. They've been translated into a lot of languages. But according to her Wikipedia entry, she has...
Which means nothing.
What's that? Yeah, which means nothing.
Next to nothing, but continue.
According to an interview that she gave to a website that specializes in Italian mysteries that is cited on her Wikipedia page, she requested that her books not be translated into Italian, and so they have not been.
That is intriguing.
Then at number 2, Mary Higgins Clark, who is now 84 years old, her latest book is called I've Got You Under My Skin, and that enters the list at number 2.
Two octogenarians on the list this week.
Yeah, at least two, yeah, that's right. Then at number 1, J.R. Ward, not an octogenarian. J.R. Ward writes paranormal romance books. Her latest is called The King. It is book 12 of her Black Dagger Brotherhood series. She also writes contemporary romances under her real name, Jessica Byrd. Her J.R. Ward books, they often open big. Her last book also debuted at number 1 on the hardcover fiction list. And then they disappear. They're kind of like these movies that open big and don't stick around. J.R. Ward's last book opened at number 1, and a couple of weeks later it wasn't on the list at all. So... who knows, maybe this time she'll buck the trend. She does open again at number 1 with The King.
Sounds very abnormal. Paranormal. Okay, what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, there are 4 new titles. At number 11, Scott Amon's biography, John Wayne, is new on the list at number 11. I learned from that biography something I hadn't known about John Wayne, whose real name was Duke Morrison, that he was an avid reader. He was a slow reader, but he was an avid reader starting from his childhood. And he really liked kind of popular crime novels and potboilers. He was big into Sir Walter Scott and James Fenimore Cooper, that kind of thing. And as an adult then, he read Agatha Christie. A big fan of Winston Churchill, John Ford. So that was something that I learned from that biography. Then at number 6, Kay Robertson, who is part of the Duck Commander family, has a book called The Women of Duck Commander, co-written with Beth Clark. It was written by Kay and the wives of the Duck Dynasty men. At number 2 on the hardcover nonfiction list, Matt Kibbe, who runs the political think tank Freedom Works, which is a right-leaning libertarian group and a big supporter of the Tea Party. His new book is called Don't Hurt People and Don't Take Their Stuff. The subtitle is A Libertarian Manifesto. And at number 1, the financial nonfiction writer Michael Lewis has a book called Flash Boys that is all about high-frequency trading on the stock markets, the computer-driven trading since the markets turned electric.
And there's some interesting developments on the paperback list as well.
Well, there is one book on the paperback nonfiction list that I wanted to mention. It's a paperback original, which means this is a book that has not appeared in hardcover and likely will not appear in hardcover. Our Bookends contributor, Leslie Jameson, has a debut collection of essays called The Empathy Exams. It's been getting terrific reviews everywhere. It's published by the small press Gray Wolf out of Minnesota. So another small press making its appearance felt on the paperback nonfiction list. This is a book called The Empathy Exams, and it's new at number 11.
And Leslie was on our podcast last week to talk about it, if you want to check back at the old podcasts.
Clearly why it's on the bestseller.
But of course. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.